Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. As always, thank them for their time, but also for their expertise. And I can address that issue personally, I might add, but I will leave it for the moment. As always, we have joining us Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell with Harvell and Collins. And with that, Cecil, good afternoon to you.
Good morning, Lockwood.
Good morning.
Good Tuesday morning.
Yes, and good morning to you, Wes. Good morning to you as well.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
All right. So what is our topic today?
Well, last week, Lockwood, as you know, we spoke about fiduciary law litigation. And the big word, fiduciary, basically meaning a person and sometimes an institution or corporation that holds resources, properties, money on behalf of another. It's a big topic, primarily sometimes because there are lots of fiduciaries. There are executors, there are administrators, there are agents under powers of attorney, there are trustees under trust. And so each and every one of these types of fiduciaries have a standard. And Wes was explaining, and we want to kind of demystify this again this Tuesday morning, but let's begin with the fact that, and Wes will reiterate it, but Wes was explaining that there's a burden shift in the proof relative to these cases when they are litigated. And so, Wes, let me let you explain that for us.
Right. So basically what I was explaining last week was that in your typical situation, the plaintiff has to carry the burden of proof. For example, in the most basic of concepts, you know, we think of civil litigation, maybe a situation like a car accident, where the plaintiff, the person who has been injured in the accident, is filing suit against the person who was negligent. And just for basic terminology, ran into the plaintiff, okay, and was negligent in operating their vehicle, and the plaintiff was damaged as a result of that negligence. So it's the plaintiff's burden of proof to really prove two very basic things. Number one, that the defendant was liable, and number two, what your damages are, like your medical damages, pain and suffering, lost wages, those type of things. So that's your typical order of the burden of proof. There could be an additional burden of proof there for the defendant, which goes into contributory negligence, but that gets complicated. So that's your typical situation. So in the fiduciary litigation context, it's a somewhat rare situation in the law that's presented in fiduciary litigation where if you're acting as a fiduciary for someone, and the allegation is that you breached your duty and benefited yourself as a result, that would be like an executor of an estate, basically using estate money for their own purposes. That would be like someone under a power of attorney changing an account so that upon the death of the principal, it passes all to the power of attorney or the agent under the power of attorney. The burden then shifts to the person who was using the power of attorney to prove basically a negative that did not breach the fiduciary duty.
In other words, they have to prove their innocence.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
It's a burden shift. Now, I would go one step further and say that the fiduciary duty does not always only come into play when there is an official capacity in place, such as an executor or an administrator under an estate or a trustee or a agent under a power of attorney. Those are some of the things that we mentioned last week. But you can be considered to be in a fiduciary capacity just because of a relationship. Certainly a fiduciary capacity, for example, if you have some power under a business, that would be a fiduciary capacity. There are some cases in North Carolina indicating that you're in a fiduciary capacity if you're acting, for example, as the of course, attorney for your client.
Right.
Even in a family context, even if there's not a power of attorney, but we have put a particular person in place and there's a high level of trust in this person, family member, to help take care of, let's say, financial affairs for the principal. That can even rise to the level of a fiduciary duty. Now, under those circumstances, the court would have to make a determination as to whether the evidence would support there being a fiduciary duty, thereby shifting the burden to the fiduciary to then carry the burden of proof.
Wes, let me interrupt for a quick question here. And this has to do with the fact that it sounds almost like a passive form of fiduciary responsibility, in the sense that there may not be a contractual arrangement. Is that conceivable? Is that what I'm hearing from you, that because of my relationship with my brother or my family, my mother or what have you, I still have some fiduciary responsibility, so I could be held accountable for that? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, you're correct. And the way that comes about, Lockwood, is that let's say that I am, as the attorney, drafting the complaint. Now, the complaint is the document that we file in court to start the lawsuit, okay? Well, while I'm drafting the complaint, if what I'm hearing from my client rises to the level in my mind that potentially there's a family-type fiduciary duty, then I'm going to make an allegation in that complaint that based on the trust and the family and the relationship and the obligations this person had, a fiduciary duty arose. Now, when I make that allegation, I'm very interested in how the defendant on the other side of the case is going to answer that allegation.
Uh-huh. All right.
If they answer it that they admit, yes, there was a fiduciary duty, then, hey, that issue's over. That means the burden has shifted to the other side.
Okay.
If they deny that, then obviously that doesn't mean that there wasn't one. That means that really the burden still lies with me to prove that there was a fiduciary duty, and if the court agrees that there was, then that shifts the burden at that point in time.
Okay.
So you start that with making the proper allegations in the complaint.
Wow. This, of course, fiduciary responsibility, I had never considered that in relationship, but I can imagine now. It's an understanding due to your relationship to the family or to an individual or to the business, and so therefore there's an issue of trust is really what we're talking about.
Right. It can be. I mean, we talked about the formal aspects of that last week with the types of offices that are held, power of attorney, trustee, executor, for example, where as a matter of law, that's a fiduciary role. But yes, you can have a fiduciary duty without having that formality of a designation of one of those titles.
We're with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. We're talking about fiduciary responsibility today. And, of course, I asked that question last week. Is it conceivable to separate yourself from those fiduciary responsibilities, and can you do so with a certain degree of impunity?
Well, you can, of course, you can communicate, and of course, communications are always best if they're in writing.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, Lockwood, you can communicate that I am, you know, no longer going to be placed in a position where I have to, you know, make decisions with regard to your property, be it land, be it money, be it stocks, bonds, whatever the case might be. Now, under a power of attorney, there is always, as one would expect, Lockwood, a resignation provision, which is why we have alternates, that hereby if John Doe resigns, then Mary Doe is the agent. If not Mary Doe, then Susan Doe, the same in a will. I hereby appoint my executor A, but if A is unable or unwilling, then I appoint B. If B is unwilling or unable, then I appoint C, the same in a trust. So, and we do have many files where folks will begin acting as a fiduciary under a power of attorney or as the executor or as the trustee, and then they will consult with us, and they will say that I am no longer going to serve in that capacity. And so we then, at that point, Lockwood, would follow the document and have the fiduciary resign, if you will, but pursuant to the terms that may be in the document. Sometimes maybe the document might require 30 days notice or whatever the case might be, to have the fiduciary unwind and no longer serve in that capacity. I want to mention, Lockwood, that, you know, if we own a piece of land and we think that the market is at an all-time high,
right,
then you know, you, Lockwood Phillips, yeah, decide, well, Nikki and I are going to sell that property.
Right.
Okay. Well, guess what? Nikki and Lockwood own the property, mm-hmm, and therefore they can make that decision. If, on the other hand, your property is being held in a fiduciary capacity, then they have to act reasonably. They don't have to act perfectly, and they don't have to hold a crystal ball, if you will, but they have to act in a manner whereby folks would deem their actions to be reasonable. Now, that's maybe some listeners are saying, my goodness, Cecil, what a hullabaloo of words. And I understand that, but what would a reasonable person do? You know, that's just so different than a person stealing money or clearly making a mistake, uh-huh, with regard to the management of money. We have fiduciaries right now. In fact, I have an email just yesterday from a son. He has two sisters. He is the executor. They have inherited a large stock portfolio.
Uh-huh.
And his email to me is, you know, Cecil, I really think we need to liquidate,
uh-huh,
this stock portfolio pretty soon. Mom has died and Dad has died. We've gotten a step up in basis,
right,
for capital gain. And what if all of a sudden, you know, a missile goes off in Korea or, mm-hmm, this war in Ukraine escalates beyond just Russia and Ukraine? The market already has had a downturn a bit, I think, Lockwood. But what if there is just, you know,
right,
a world event? And so my response back to him was, well, I think you have a good argument to be made. You're acting like a reasonable person,
mm-hmm,
that with the world being in the conditions that it's in right now, maybe the time is just, and in light of the fact that there is this step up in basis in all the stocks, let's go ahead and liquidate it.
Right.
So that decision was made yesterday. And that would be what would be called a reasonable decision, Lockwood. He could have made the decision that we're going to continue to hold on to it. But all the facts and circumstances are the things that the ultimately the litigators are talking to judges and clerks of court about, and all of the facts and circumstances are considered. And, of course, under those circumstances, I think his actions are most reasonable.
That leads me to the question I wanted to ask. Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins with us, along with Wes Collins. We're talking about fiduciary responsibilities here. Cecil, that was one of the things I was thinking about in relationship to, obviously, the fiduciary is responsible for the taking care of the principal. Let's say, for example, the parents. However, you've got other family members who might be ranked below them in fiduciary responsibility. In other words, if I decide to give up my responsibility, I hand it over to Wes Collins or to Cecil Harvell. But the point is that those other members of the family may decide that I'm not doing a good enough job. So what is my cover or my protection, mm-hmm, as well as what is their duties and responsibilities?
Well, we get these questions all the time. Wes's office is full of these questions where someone has some other member of the family,
mm-hmm,
believes that the agent under the power of attorney is not making good decisions.
Right.
Or the executor of the estate is not making good decisions. And that I am the next in line under the document, and I think that my sister or my brother should resign in favor of me,
mm-hmm,
because they are not making the right decisions. And here are the examples of where I believe their decisions have been faulty. Well, okay, this is a big topic, Lockwood. That's why we're talking about it.
Right.
You know, sometimes this is not crystal clear, and we just have to look at the facts and the circumstances. Let me say this real quick, and we, of course, as always, time is running by, but to remove an executor who has been duly qualified, clerks of courts and superior court judges do not like that.
Okay. Right.
They believe that that person was appointed by the testator of the will, and that absent just some egregious abuse of discretion and power, are they going to remove the executor? A mere mistake, maybe a misjudgment in a way, a miscalculation, that's not going to be enough to remove an executor, or I might add, even a trustee or power of attorney, agent under a power of attorney. The facts need to be very clear, convincing. There needs to be some real teeth in those kinds of actions. A lot of times, more than anything else, and unfortunately, there's emotion, tremendous amount of emotion,
right,
and history, psychological history between family members. And we understand that, and we are sympathetic to that, but just an allegation that, you know, I could do it better, or I would have done it a little bit differently, that's not going to be sufficient to remove a duly appointed fiduciary in a document.
Go back to the scenario that you gave just a moment ago, Cecil, where the individual who's a fiduciary makes a decision to sell the stock under the circumstances. Well, let's say in 6 months that the Dow Jones is up 25%. It's not going to happen, but let's say it is. Well, we could have a lot of very unhappy beneficiaries.
Yeah, disgruntled. Yeah.
Scenario. My goodness, you went to cash. Everything's
right.
Cash. We lost 25%. That was
right.
That in no way, shape, or form will result in a removal of that fiduciary.
Okay.
That is a situation where that person did the best they could under the circumstances. But you contrast that with situations where you have either repeated failure to do things, such as the necessary filings in a state administration, or you fail to provide information upon a proper request under the statute, let's say under an estate or under a trust, and you just continue to fail to do that, that can be the basis for removal. We've had some really egregious cases where executors have been incredibly greedy, to put it nicely, with regard to helping themselves to money in an estate. That type of thing, of course, is it would be grounds for removal. It has to be, you know, something very, very specific like that.
Is there then a punitive response? Let's say in an instance where an individual has been greedy, as you said. Oh, let's say, for example, they've paid themselves too much for doing some of the standard duties of the responsibility as fiduciary. For example, they had to travel somewhere, so they stayed in first-class hotels, things of this nature. Is there a way for the estate to recover some of those misspent monies?
Yes.
Wow.
In that circumstance, one of several things normally happens. When we identify those types of issues, then sometimes the fiduciary, normally through the advice of legal counsel on the other side, will purge themselves of the problem. Let's say that they paid themselves too much, or they paid for too much, then maybe they will agree to reimburse the estate, and then we just proceed on. Okay?
All right.
That would be one way to do it. The next way would be that, okay, they say, oh, I always stay in the Ritz-Carlton.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, I wanted to stay in the Ritz-Carlton on the estate's dime when I had to go to Atlanta or to Miami or wherever I had to go for this estate administration. You know, never mind I stayed in the Ritz-Carlton for a whole week, but I only had to be there a day.
Right.
So, then we would most likely have to have a hearing on that issue.
Wow.
And the executor would then have to come forward and give a description and explanation as to why they have you know, rented the most expensive car,
mm-hmm.
and stayed in the most expensive restaurant. And, you know, one that just always gets me, Lockwood, is all of these meals I had to pay for when I was traveling on this trip. Well, you know, if you're at home, you would be eating too.
Right.
So, you know, but be it as it may, yes, we see that sometimes. And that, those are the types of things that the clerk of court, wherever the estate is pending, will conduct the hearing and hear the evidence and make a determination as to whether the letters of testamentary should be revoked as a result, or potentially some other type of remedy. But that is the most likely remedy. We're going to remove you, and then the order as part of that removal would be a requirement that the individual reimburse the estate for X amount of dollars.
Talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, we're talking about fiduciary responsibilities. Two quick questions for you. We talked about fiduciary responsibilities. In a case of a fiduciary, an individual, myself, and we need to take care of a particular situation, obviously communications always works best. Should we map out in advance exactly what responsibilities or duties or actions should be taken for a particular case? Let's say, for example, the sale of a piece of property. We've got to hire a surveyor. We've got to do certain things. We may have to travel somewhere to take care of some documentation. Is there a way to sort of bullet point those items so as to avoid a conflict?
Well, that's just good. Hopefully there's good communication.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, one of the things that that we need to mention is the appraisal.
Right.
If there's any question whatsoever about value, then the fiduciary, the executor, the trustee, the power of attorney, should have an appraisal done.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they need even more than one appraisal. If it's really, you know, a sticky situation with regard to what the value might be, unusual property,
mm-hmm.
Things of that nature. Well, these appraisals then should be given, a copy of them should be distributed to the other interested parties so that they are given, or so that they're in the loop of information. Absolutely. Communication can really help, can win the day.
Right.
Whereas keeping things with a fiduciary very secretive and not communicating, that sometimes is the very thing that we hear at the very first appointments from other family members,
mm-hmm.
that are complaining, is that, well, you know, I haven't received any information at all.
Gotcha.
I don't know what's going on.
Right.
My brother is not communicating to me.
Uh-huh.
We haven't heard a word, and my dad has been dead now for 9 months,
ooh,
almost a year. Aren't we supposed to be in the information loop? And the
right.
answer is that, yes, there is this fiduciary duty, and part of that is that there be some communication. So,
the next question then goes to the potential of responsibility of a fiduciary. And obviously, we talked about this earlier, that some folks find themselves in fiduciary responsibility and not necessarily wanting to be there. Is there some form of protection? I'm going to use the term, is there an insurance policy, for example, that a fiduciary might want to engage? Because this could get pretty tense at various points.
Lockwood, you're going to love this answer. Hire a good lawyer. Okay.
That's okay.
And I don't mean that.
No.
I don't mean that in a whatever kind of facetious kind of way,
right, right.
or sarcasm. Just get someone to dot some I's and cross some T's with you. Get a professional to run the scenarios by. Don't go out here as an agent under a power of attorney or an executor in a complicated estate with issues, and begin to just, you know, go about it in your own way. Seek some advice. I also think that accountants, good accountants, mm-hmm. are very good people on the team, if you will. A fiduciary needs to develop a little bit of a team. They need to have a good accountant. They need to have a good lawyer. This doesn't mean, Lockwood, at all, that the accountants and the lawyers are going to bill tens of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just might be, a few hours with the lawyer or a few hours with the accountant. But run your decisions by your decisions by other professionals, so that you have some documentation on that. It is very important, I think, that fiduciaries realize that's the purpose of our program last week and this week, and we might conclude with this. It's important that fiduciaries understand that these are not their resources.
Right,
and that they
right.
do need to seek guidance, and that maybe the guidance is only going to be a few hours, but it's going to be, it's going to be worth its weight in gold. Absolutely seek some advice if you are a fiduciary, because it's a different world than acting with your own resources, making your own decisions, which no one else has the right to question. When you are holding money, resources, property on behalf of another, you need to, there's a heightened alert. You need to dot your I's, cross your T's, and then dot them and cross them again. And sometimes the best money that can be spent is a few hours in consultation with a good accountant, a good lawyer, about the decisions that you're going to make. And that's the insurance policy, Lockwood, that you mentioned. Those would be the very questions that someone like Wes would ask in depositions and in the courtroom, which is, well, didn't you think to seek advice on
mm-hmm.
this? Did you
right.
hire an attorney? Did you talk to a CPA? You mean you didn't seek any advice on any of these decisions that you were making? That's not going to play real well, because a reasonable person, Lockwood, would consult and seek some professional advice.
So what I'm hearing from you both is that several things. One, as a fiduciary, as you've said many times, it's not your property. You're a keeper of a corporate property with a variety of interests, family members, parties that are responsible or to gain from this principle, if you will. And the other aspect of directly related to that is that in your capacity as fiduciary, you have these significant responsibilities. So, to your point, seek guidance. And I would also question, it's also from the perspective of the person establishing who the fiduciary is, that they should also be very serious about who they determine will be the first and secondary and third tertiary responsible parties.
Yes. And they are. They usually, folks appointing their fiduciary under a power of attorney,
uh-huh.
under a will, under a trust, usually are thinking very seriously about that appointment. Who is the best? Who will make reasonable decisions? Who is, stable? Who will be prompt and responsive,
uh-huh.
who will seek out legal advice and accounting advice, and is not a, quote, know-it-all,
mm-hmm.
If you will.
Yeah, right.
And then last I want to say, and I'm repeating myself from last week, we'd rather have this reasonable person who will act in a sound and prudent way from California or Washington State or Istanbul, rather than have the wrong person, but they're from, Newport, North Carolina.
Sure.
It doesn't matter where your fiduciary happens to reside.
Very good point. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon. Harvell and Collins, and I keep saying afternoon this morning, Harvell and Collins, and just to remind you, you can go to the website, Harvell, and spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com, or give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050. And with that, Wes and Cecil, thank you very much for your time.